welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We help business creators like you win at the game of business and marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment, visit our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com, where you will find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator, and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Let's get into today's episode. My name is Adam Homey. I am your host. I am honored by your wise decision to tune in and invest in yourself today. Get your pad of paper and two pens ready for the aha moments. Today, we are going to have a very interesting topic. This is going to be exciting. It's going to be information loaded, and it's going to have a lot of things that you're going to be able to apply to your business as you serve from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. And it's about the feeling economy and how humans can effectively partner with advanced artificial intelligence in the coming feeling economy. That's a lot of stuff to put together. And the good news is we have somebody who can disambiguate this for us. His name is Roland T. Rust. He's a distinguished university professor, the David Bruce Smith Chair in Marketing, and founder and executive director of the Center of Excellence and Service at the Robert H. Smith School of Business, University of Maryland. As an award-winning writer and researcher, Roland has edited several major journals and consulted with American Airlines, AT&T, DuPont, Eli Lilly, FedEx, Lockheed Martin, Microsoft, NASA, and Sony, among many companies worldwide. Ming-Hui Huang is, I believe that's a partner of his, is a distinguished research fellow at the Center of Excellence at the same School of Business. And I can also share with you that that is Roland's co-author, so I'll tell you a little bit about them. They are, as I said, a distinguished research fellow at the Center of Excellence and Service at that same Robert H. Smith School of Business, University of Maryland, and a distinguished professor, Department of Information Management, College of Management, National Taiwan University, and is a leading research and frequent contributor to both academic and managerial journals in artificial intelligence and service. She is also the editor-in-chief-elect of the Journal of Service Research. So I'm just sharing this with you to let you know who Roland works with. And together, they have created a new book, and that's what we're going to be discussing today. It's called The Feeling Economy, How Artificial Intelligence is Creating the Era of Empathy. And it is produced by Springer International Publishing. It's available on Amazon. For right now, I'd like to introduce you to Roland T. Rust. Roland, come on in. The weather's fine.
I'm here.
All right. So I just read off this very impressive bio that I'm not even sure I'm worthy to be here, and it's my show. So what do we like to do here before we dive in? And I know you have a lot of great stuff to download to us today. I read off that bio, tells us some of what you're up to right now, which is great, a little bit about your background. But tell us a bit about your journey so that our listeners can understand what's brought you to where you are today, serving business creators from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion the way you do it.
Sure. Yeah, I really started out in mathematics, which is very unusual, perhaps, for somebody in my field. But I started out in mathematics. But eventually, the thing that really turned me on was service. And that was a very good career move for me, because the service economy is actually the vast majority of the economy today. And so we kind of got in at the time when that was really just growing. And so that was a really good move. But then what I've been most interested in is what makes service change. And what makes service change more than anything else is technology. And the big thing that's happening right now in technology is artificial intelligence. So Ming-Hui and I have been working on technology issues and how they affect business for quite some time. And this book is the latest result of that.
Awesome. That's absolutely fantastic. And, you know, especially with some shifts we're seeing in the economy, with everything that's happened over the past year, some political changes and agenda changes and everything else, technology is becoming so much more involved in service, especially when we've physically lost touch to the degree that we used to have just a year ago, and to the degree to which even once we deal with this bug that's been floating around, some of that's never really going to come back. And the reason I say that is because over the past year, we've been programmed to do all this social distancing stuff, and we've been conditioned to be so much more concerned about touching things and being in the same room as people and even interacting with people. And that has actually opened the floodgates to answering questions like, well, if I can't have people in my physical plant, how can I still render these services? If I can't afford the people because of the economy shift, how do I still render the customer service? And I believe that artificial intelligence and things like that are going to become much more prime, and they're going to go undergo a very complex and very rapid pace of development. So that's actually kind of why I wanted to have you here today, Roland. But first of all, could we please identify some terms? Explain to me what you mean by this phrase, feeling economy. And I'm wondering if I just touched on it.
What we really mean by the feeling economy is an economy in which feeling tasks are more important than thinking tasks.
Uh-huh.
And that sounds really weird to people because we've been in the thinking economy for, decades. And there have really been two major shifts related to technology and artificial intelligence in the last 150 years or so. The first was a shift away from things like mining and manufacturing things like farming even. And those tasks, a lot of those kinds of heavy physical sort of tasks were taken over by AI really early on. So for example, if you go into a car factory, I visited a car factory in China in 1998, and they were building every car basically by hand. The factories were full of people, and they were all making the cars one piece at a time. If you go into China today, or if you go to Japan, or if you go to the United States and take a look at what's happening now, it's totally different. It's totally different. All the cars are being made by robots. And so that was the first shift. The first shift was, sorry, you can't be a factory worker anymore. You've got to, study STEM skills and become a thinking person.
Yeah.
And that was the first shift. And of course, a lot of people were kind of left out by that. You saw a lot of the people that used to work in the factories or used to work on the farms, used to work in the mines. Those parts of the country are in trouble because those people have lost their jobs. And now, before we've even fully solved that transformation, we're now seeing a second transformation. And the second transformation is even more important, because what it's doing is it's getting rid of thinking tasks. So you have things like IBM Watson, for example, doing AI for companies, and you have that as something that is taking people away from those tasks that they used to do, those analytical tasks. And Ming Wei and I did a study using government data try to find out what was happening in the economy, because we expected to see that. And in fact, we did see that. But what surprised us, even us, was that it's really happening faster than we expected. And it's happening across the board. So for example, somebody like a financial analyst, when you think of a financial analyst as being very technical,
yeah,
right? But we were able to show that the importance of feeling tasks for that job have increased dramatically over the last 10 or 15 years. And the degree to which that was true really surprised even us.
Surprises me a little bit too, because the last thing I think of when I think of financial analysts is feelings. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm just saying that the moment you say the words financial analyst to me, I don't even see a person, I see a spreadsheet.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, but you know, I was presenting this at a conference about a year ago, before the pandemic hit, and a person who was a financial analyst from one of the major financial companies came up to me after the talk, and he said, "You know, what you're saying is absolutely right. You know, in my job, I don't really do those technical things anymore. I let the AI do that. And what I do is I basically hold hands. You know, I try to reassure people when the market goes down and try to not have them do crazy stuff." So, you know, that person has become much more of a feeling person, much more of an interpersonal relationship person instead of a technical person. It changes who is going to succeed in that job. You know, the technical geek, the sort of stereotypical Silicon Valley geek, you know, like you see in some TV sitcoms. I mean, those people are in trouble now because, you know, they may not have the people skills to be able to get the job done.
Right. And, you know, we're at a point right now, and I alluded to this earlier, where people are looking for that human connection. Regardless of what approach you take to that issue, the fact is, it's just there. And you know, we've seen enough about artificial intelligence. I can give you a real simple, I mean, you know this better than I do, but for our listeners, a real simple example of artificial intelligence is the use of marketing bots. So you go to somebody's Facebook page and you go to their, you go to the chat window for their business page and you find yourself communicating with a bot. You go to the chat window on a website, which you're used to the idea there's a person behind there, but a lot of times you end up speaking with a scripted bot and you're asking for help and they keep saying, "Come to my event." So the perceptions of artificial intelligence are that it's still kind of artificial. So what I want to do is I want to get into that a little bit and show that, show how artificial intelligence can improve and how it can be part of the feeling economy. So if you could tell us about that, because you say that it's going to be a real big change, not just a trend, but actually a change in the economy.
Yeah, that's right. And we're seeing this major change as a result of AI getting good at the things that we used to be better at. And the chatbot idea is perfect because that's where a computer is trying to do people work, and it's not usually very good right now.
Yeah.
But it's the reason that they do it is because it's cheaper. So in other words, AI doesn't have to be better than people. It just has to be sort of almost as good, but cheaper. And that will get the job done. Companies will still adopt it because they'll make money. They may not make quite as much revenue, but their costs go down.
Right. Yeah. And another example is artificial intelligence transcripts. I've tried to get transcripts done of recordings using artificial intelligence offerings, and I've gotten the results back and wondering, am I delirious? Do I have some sort of like personality disconnect disorder or something? There's no way in hell I said some of the crap I'm reading right now. And who are these five people that are being identified as the interlocutor? I only remember one other person being in this conversation, which is why for now, for my transcript needs, I send them all to zoomscribe.com, where I get a human being who's a native English speaker, one member of their, their team are native speaking English speakers, and they can get me something turned around at a very reasonable rate that's going to come back in the same version of American English that I speak, give or take a word or two. But these artificial intelligence transcripts, holy heck! So at the same time, I believe that technology has a role to play in helping us be more efficient about things that used to take us a lot of time. One example is note-taking. We record more of our stuff, but then we still need the written word. So we can push a button and have a machine give us back accurately what we said.
Yeah, and the machines are getting better and better at that, and they'll eventually be very good. But right now they still have some problems. And the problem that they have is they don't understand context. So that's the issue. I mean, they may know what words you're using, but they don't know how to put them together because they don't understand what the words are all about. They don't understand the situation that you're describing. They don't understand the context. Because that requires common sense. And humans are great at common sense. They're fantastic. I mean, babies are born with some degree of common sense. So, that is something that is a human skill that will last for a little while. And that's the kind of thing that humans need to be better at than AI if they want to survive. But even eventually there will be something called general intelligence that AI achieves. And at that point, AI will have the ability to put together some things in terms of common sense. And at that point, that pushes people more and more and more to the interpersonal side, the feeling side, because one thing that a computer can't do is feel.
Yeah, here's another thing. And I was just yesterday when I was doing some of my recreational reading, I was getting into different dialects around the United States. See, I'm one of those people that if you put me on the Wikipedia, I can get really dangerous really quickly. I can read one article, and by the time I finish that one article, I've opened up 14 other articles it was linked to in separate browser tabs. And then each one has its own rabbit hole. So yesterday, I think I sat there and read about 30 different dialects of American English. I live in Las Vegas. I've been here for almost 8 years. Mm-hmm. You know how many people have just hearing me speak before we'd even been introduced, just walked up to me and said, "Hey, are you from Pittsburgh?"
Yeah, that's good.
I don't think I have an accent, but apparently I do.
It's not really noticeable to me. That's interesting that people say that. They must.
You're not geographically too far from Pittsburgh. They're actually, and some of my studies show that based on where you're physically located, where you've probably been located at least for a while and have been somewhat acclimated to where you are, there are overlaps between the between the dialects. So if I say Jagoff, you probably know what I mean.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And I grew up in Indiana. So I grew up in Indiana, live in the D.C. area now, and halfway between those is Pittsburgh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that dialect spread kind of actually overlaps with the two dialects in those two areas you just described. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they're influenced by some of the same cultures, because the same waves of immigration to the United States a little over 100 years ago, when we began our kickstart version of the Industrial Revolution, came from those same areas in Central and Eastern Europe. So a lot of the loan words and a lot of the implied meanings are common to all three of those areas. But the thing is, does a machine designed by somebody in Houston know that?
Yeah. And Pittsburgh is an interesting case, because that's really a very good example of these two shifts. Because Pittsburgh was a big steel town.
Yep.
And then what happened was, as the steel mills started to be taken over basically by automation and artificial intelligence, and to some degree also overseas, cheaper steel mills overseas. But that was something that really drove Pittsburgh to the next stage of the development, which was basically moving to service, more cleaner industries.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I grew up not too far from a town called Denora, Pennsylvania. And anybody who's involved in environmental issues has probably heard of the Denora smog. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was a foreman in one of those mills that caused it. Mm-hmm. He was stuck there while it happened. It probably shortened his life by about 5 years because he was exposed to it.
Yeah, yeah. And today, Pittsburgh is actually one of the places where AI is advancing, because you have Carnegie Mellon right there. And so some of the Carnegie Mellon researchers are bringing AI to the fore now in the Pittsburgh region. So it's interesting that Pittsburgh is such a microcosm of really this big shift that's happening.
Well, there are a couple shifts in Pittsburgh. I mean, one of which is it's become a leader when it comes to healthcare. And you know, technology and online technology is also a really big industry there. In fact, a lot of the former steel mills have actually been torn down and replaced by or retrofitted as technology parks.
Yeah, there's a lot of retrofitting going on right now in the economy, and we're going to see more because, as I say, this shift is very dramatic and very extreme.
Yeah, it is. So we have a number of different places we can go in the rest of our time together here, and you've given me a few points, so I'm going to go through some of them. You say, and this is of interest to a number of our listeners, because we have a number of listeners that are very interested in this topic, that the feeling economy will be a time of unprecedented power and influence for women. Why do you say that?
Well, it's mainly because women, on average, tend to be better at empathy. Okay. And the reason for that is really based on brain physiology, that men have brains that are more hemispherically specialized, and women less so, on average. You know, there are huge differences within gender. So, for example, there can be a very empathetic man, there can be a very technically capable woman. You know, that happens, but on average, women are more capable on the empathy side. And so what happened was, if you think about it in terms of these big shifts, in the physical economy, men had a big advantage because they were bigger. You know, it's a simple physical advantage. And so women were definitely kind of kept down at that particular time. They weren't able to have an equal role in society. But then as the thinking economy came in, women were just as good at thinking as men for the most part. And so, you know, you have a huge advance in women in terms of income, in terms of education, et cetera, in the thinking economy. And now what we believe is that the feeling economy will accelerate that. And in fact, women will pass men in terms of being more likely to be the people that are in charge. And you're seeing that already in various countries of the world. If you take a look at the countries of the world that are most friendly to women, those countries tend to have a GDP that's several times as large as the average GDP in the world.
Can you name a couple countries for me just so that we can visually see this?
Sure. Germany, the United States, all of Scandinavia. Those are countries that, for example, New Zealand. You take a look at New Zealand. It's run by a woman, Jacinda Ardern. And what she was really good at in the pandemic was empathy. So, for example, one thing she did was she said, okay, we're going to officially name the Easter Bunny to be an essential worker.
Okay.
So the kids didn't get freaked out. You know, they said they can still work. The Easter Bunny can still work. And so, you know, that is the sort of empathy that you're not going to get from very many men. That's very, very unusual. And also in Taiwan, where my wife and co-author Ming Hui is from, it's run by a woman. The prime minister is a woman. She has an epidemiological or health background. And Taiwan has done a fantastic job with the pandemic, much better than, let's say, the United States or even Western Europe. So, the ability of women to understand and empathize and then do appropriate things that actually help people or make them feel better, that's what we're seeing more and more. So we're likely to see more and more women in major positions like that. For example, you know, Germany is one of the top countries in the world in terms of their economics, and they're run by a woman, have been for years.
Okay. Yeah. I And I think when you look at the larger picture of what's going on right now, over the past year, Roland, we've had this cataclysmic change in the trajectory of how everything was going. I pointed out early on that one of the silver linings of the coronavirus thing was that this resistance to the idea of virtual and remote work was going to get blown right out of the water, because now it's either you let your people work from home or they don't work for you at all.
That's right.
And I've been a big advocate for remote work for a long time. Ever since when I was in corporate, I have a story of, it was December of 2002 and I was living in Pittsburgh at the time. We had gotten this freak snowstorm that had not been predicted. There was nothing in the news the night before that said there was a snowstorm coming. Woke up, there were 5 inches of snow on the ground. So, because it wasn't predicted, wasn't expected, the roads weren't getting worked on the way they normally should. I lived an hour from where I worked. I could not physically get there because they had not come to plow my road.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I was involved in two departments. I worked for two departments at the company I worked for, both of which had live events going on that day that needed to be rescheduled, and I was the person to do it. So what do you think I, as a conscientious person, did? I logged on to the VPN network, and I used my home phone, and I made the necessary arrangements. And what do you think that got me?
They probably gave you a lot of credit for that.
No, they didn't give me a lot of credit. They told me that I had a choice of either taking a vacation day or getting written up for it because I violated a work from home policy.
Oh boy, that's crazy.
And you know where that came from? It came from some guy and senior management who just had to show off the fact that his title had the word chief in it and he could do something about something. I said the word jag off earlier. I hope he's listening so he knows that I think he's one to this day. But the reason I bring this up is because there was absolutely no empathy there whatsoever. And you know what else I was told? I was told, well, you should have had your backup person do it. Well, meanwhile, this person they kept insisting was my backup person refused to back me up because she said it wasn't her job and she was tired of being put upon being told to do other people's jobs. So what you had across the board was there was no empathy toward her either. There was no outreach to her to help her feel good about the idea of being a team player because I had conversations with her about it, and she had a long list of grievances about her efforts to be a team player and being punished for it.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't her job. So there was no empathy there. There was no human feeling. You want to talk about a feeling economy? It wasn't there. Now, hopefully in the past 20 years, because that company is still there. In fact, they've grown considerably. They're doing very good, actually. I hope that within their management styles, they've developed a lot more empathy. And if you want to go to another point, I usually check them out about once a year just to see what they're up to. And I've noticed that their senior management team is now mostly female.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
So I asked this for a reason. I was actually going here. I just didn't want to announce it up front.
Yeah, no, that doesn't surprise me at all. And in fact, if men want to be successful in that kind of environment, they're going to have to be more of what used to be called feminine. They're going to have to show some of these more feminine traits like empathy. They're going to have to show that and not think about it as being weak or, you know, it's not masculine or whatever. People are going to have to get used to that. You're going to have to get good at it.
Yeah. Part of my role in working with small businesses is while I don't usually carry the label coach because then it puts connotations on me, I end up doing some of that work without labeling it coaching. So I had a situation a few months ago where it was my client had some concerns about one of their team members and their performance. And that team member had some concerns about the client and the demands that client was putting upon the team member. So what I did is, using as much empathy as I could drum up, I listened to what they said. I allowed them to process what they had to say about each other without passing any judgment, without defending one to the other or anything like that. And very subtly, I just planted the seed with both of them that what would probably really solve it is if they just took 10 minutes to speak with each other. Next thing you know, I heard from both of them. Hey, I just spoke with, insert the other person's name. And it was a really awesome conversation. I didn't actually tell them to do that. I just merely gently suggested that perhaps a direct conversation could be helpful. But what I did there is I removed any judgment from the conversation, and I gave both of them the opportunity to speak freely to someone they could trust, speaking from their truth and what they were feeling.
Yeah, that's great. That's exactly what empathy is. I mean,
yeah.
Empathy really involves a couple of different things. It involves at least understanding what the other person is doing. You know, where are they coming from? You have to understand where they're coming from. But ideally, empathy goes even deeper than that, because ideally, empathy means you actually feel what the other person's feeling.
In both cases, I could, because I know what it's like to be a client who feels frustrated because they're not getting what they need from the person they're paying. And I know what it feels like to have a client who's not giving me what I need to do my job.
Yeah.
And in none of those cases was it ever a value judgment about the person. And my experience has taught me that almost every time that happens, there's just simply a misalignment of understanding of what the goals are.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be solved usually as simple as that. Now, if one or the other parties is just a jerk, well, that's a different conversation. But I found the majority of cases, it's actually not.
Yeah, I think usually when you really understand somebody, then you don't think they're a jerk. That's usually how it works.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do now is I'd like to change the subject a little bit. And one thing we've been hearing about a lot the past few years is STEM. It's a very hot thing right now. It's been for years, and I think that's great. Is it going to become obsolete at some point? I thought I heard you say something like that when I was checking you out.
Yeah. I'm going to try to be completely accurate in what I say here.
Go ahead. Take your time. We got it.
STEM is going to be even more important than ever. Now, okay, that sounds like I'm contradicting myself. But here's the thing. STEM is going to be something that's done by AI. So if we think about a team of people or a team in a company, I shouldn't say a team of people, because some people on the team are going to be AI. So you've got AI as part of the team collaborating with the people part of the team. And typically the AI part will do the more technical stuff and the people will do the more people-facing part.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is STEM may not go away, but there's going to be a big change in it. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah. And what that means for humans, and most of us are humans,
humans
is that, maybe taking STEM courses is not the road to success that we think it is right now. It would have been 10, 15, 20 years ago, would have been great. But today, it may be not its time. Because you don't want to be going into a job that requires all these skills that can be immediately taken over by AI.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in one area I could think of, because especially we're talking about STEM, medical research, you can see a computer doing a lot of this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And what's driving it is something that I actually advocate, which is reducing and ultimately eliminating animal testing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, we've gotten to the point, I think, where we've studied and maimed and tortured enough animals that we know what's going to happen. I mean, we're now at a point with artificial intelligence, I believe, and tell me if I'm incorrect, where we could actually use a computer program to simulate a living being so that we can predict impacts and reactions. Are we pretty much there at that point?
Yeah, that's being done.
So if we're doing this right, we should never have to experiment on a cat again, because we can create the cat using a computer program and generate what the responses and the reactions would be.
We can almost do that.
Okay.
What's happening right now is, the problem is the brain is very complicated.
Yeah.
And even a small animal has a very complicated brain compared to the kind of computer programs that we usually build.
Don't I know it? I'm owned by two cats. and in fact, Princess Alessandra, who supervises me by sitting on my desk and staring at me all day, wanted me to bring up that point because she wants an end to all that stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, let me talk a little bit about the technology of this. It's called a digital twin.
Okay.
The idea is to be able to model inside the computer some physical thing. And right now it's being done a lot for things like, for example, the companies that are trying to make vaccines.
Yeah.
They can do a lot of that computer modeling of, what will happen if they create a molecule that looks like this? How is it going to interact with the COVID virus? So that's something that is already being done. Of course, taking that and applying it to biological beings is one order of magnitude greater than that, maybe more than one order of magnitude. It's a much harder thing to do, but that's where we're headed. And what some science fiction writers are talking about is the idea of taking your essence and putting it into digital form. In other words, suppose you can figure out every neural connection that you have and all your bodily reactions, and you actually put that in a computer. That is where we're headed. We're not there yet. It'll take a while. It'll take probably 20 years before we can think about that happening. But that's the direction we're headed. And there are some people that have talked about a concept called the singularity. The singularity is when AI becomes smarter than us at everything. And at that point, it's really hard for us to compete. And so what some people have said, like Ray Kurzweil, the guy who came up with the concept of the singularity, or at least popularized it. Ray Kurzweil says that to succeed as a species, we're going to have to become cyborgs. We're going to have to become part human and part AI. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to compete.
It's some serious Terminator stuff we're telling us.
Oh, yeah, yeah. and my feeling is that's not even going to happen. It's not good enough. Because if you have two entities, one entity is half human and half AI, and the other entity is all AI, the all AI one will win after the singularity. So from the standpoint of natural selection, those things will naturally select over us, in my opinion. Now that's scary, but fortunately we've got decades before we have to really worry about that. But I'm teaching class, with students that are in their 20s. And these students, 30 years from now, when AI is perhaps at that level, they're gonna still be in the workforce. And so I'm warning them. I'm saying, look, this is what's going to happen. You guys got to really pay attention and try to hold off AI as long as you can. Do the things where you have a differential advantage over AI, and that's the feeling part.
Yeah. Okay, that's a lot to think about, let me tell you.
Yeah, wow. It's kind of scary, but the future always looks like science fiction. Today's future looks like science fiction to 1880.
Yeah. There's something I like to point out to people. One of the things that we've had debates about lately is, of course, the coal industry. And we've seen how a few pockets of areas in the United States where the coal industry is very important can sway elections. Because it's a linchpin. Now, I'm going to inject a little bit of my own thoughts into all this, and it's going to make my point, actually. I believe that you can't just shut down the coal industry because what I don't see is there's any plan to transition those workers, skilled and unskilled, and those communities into something else. You can't just say we're taking away your manner of living and to hell with you. If you don't like it, go move somewhere else. That's not how you treat. That's not empathetic. However, what we can look at is how can we evolve coal? Now, let me go back 100 years. I saw some newspapers from right around the turn of the 20th century, and there was a huge fear that the earth was going to run out of coal. They were predicting that within 10 years, there'd be no more coal left in the world. And there was panic that we were going to get thrown right back into the Stone Age, because almost everything that we had accomplished in terms of technology, industry, and everything else went back to coal. Yeah. Now you have the coal industry that to a certain degree is on life support, because not a lot of stuff uses coal anymore. And there's still going to be coal left in the ground after they're done using it.
It's true.
And I think it's going to be the same thing with oil. We've heard about peak oil. We have the debate about becoming energy independent. My belief is the sooner that the United States, for instance, becomes fully energy independent, we don't have to rely on anybody else for anything, the faster we can get to green energy, because we can evolve it in a way that is both measured and empathetic. Now, let me link to one other train here. And I know I'm building a daisy chain of things for you to give me your thoughts on. Mm-hmm. Let's think about flat screen TVs. 20 years ago, flat screen TV was an elite toy for the wealthy. The average household, if they wanted a flat screen TV, they had to save up a year and a half for it. But now, go in a store, try and find yourself a console TV. Try and find a TV that has a curve on it. Try and find a TV that's not plasma. Try and find a TV that can't also be used as a computer monitor, because they're substantially the same thing.
Yep.
And what evolved that? It was a combination of the inexorable drive and an evolution of technology and the willingness of some people to jump first to create the sustainability. Now, I'm looking back at this, and aside from the fact that some people probably had to be retrained in their jobs or their companies may have been merged with some other company, I don't recall a lot of depression-level dislocation over the evolution of the television.
Yeah, well, the television was a lot like the radio,
yeah.
Really, in terms of how that worked technologically. So, in fact, the radio really... the person who really invented that, people say it was Marconi, but really it was Nikola Tesla.
Yeah. Well, Tesla invented everything that everybody else is given credit for. That's a separate conversation. We could have you back for a whole hour on that.
Yeah. But one thing you brought up, which I think is really crucial, is this idea of retraining. You know, you were pointing out the people in the coal industry areas that...
Which is some of my family, by the way, so I have a personal feeling about this.
Yeah, so they're having trouble because that industry no longer really exists in the same way. And so really what the government needed to do, but didn't particularly, was they needed to create a very carefully thought out retraining plan for the people who were left behind by the previous transformation. But now, of course, we got this new transformation, which means that now we have to think about retraining the thinking workers.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is something, because now we have to merge training with empathy. As I said earlier in our conversation, when you say financial analyst, I don't even think of a person, I think of a spreadsheet.
Right.
That's what immediately comes to mind, is I see the green bar at the top and the rows and the columns with numbers in them.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an empathetic disconnection there. Remember, I also qualified that by saying there's nothing wrong with financial analysts. I think they're great people and everything else. I just don't see the person. I see the spreadsheet that they're using.
Yeah.
And there's a human being behind that who's going to have feelings even as they're calculating their numbers, especially if their calculations are bringing up bad news.
Right. Now, there are some companies that are putting out ads that play on this. For example, there's one that is a financial company that they show somebody going into an office and sitting on the desk of the person in the office is an AI machine.
Yeah.
And he says, I'd like to introduce you to Techie. And Techie then does some rather clumsy and unempathetic things. And the story there is, we really need that human touch. We need the feeling, we need the empathy. That's what really adds value. And so they're taking advantage of this trend toward more AI use, and they're pointing out how humans can survive.
Yeah. Now, linking that to recent current events, one of the things that's been going on for several years now is the push to mandate higher minimum wages and all the economic dislocation that that's going to lead to, and some of the case studies from places where it's already been done and how it's actually adversely impacted in some ways the very people that it was supposed to help. I'm gonna create for our listeners a visual representation of this. You go to a fast food place, and because they can't afford to pay the person behind the cashier's stand $15 an hour, they're going to replace that person with a touchscreen machine.
That's exactly right. You're already seeing that in a lot of, especially low-end restaurants. Because the lower end a restaurant is, the more it's efficiency and cost reduction that makes the profit. And so they try to replace people as often as they can. And of course, the COVID situation has just sped everything up, because now you really don't want people in there. You want to have machines, and people don't want to touch other people right now. So this has all sped up the move to AI.
And to some degree, that can cause some, and this, I think it's a good place to go. And there's one other question I want to ask before we wrap up here that's going to be probably even a little more edgy, which I'm looking forward to, actually. You think about it from the consumer's perspective. When I order from restaurants, and I've written about this on blogs, and I've shared this on other episodes of Business Creators Radio Show, I have a practice where there's a few places, there's a few restaurants I go to regularly. Regularly to the point where when I walk in, the chances are two or three people are gonna recognize me. I mean, it's to the point where even during the various phases of this whole COVID thing that's been going on here in Nevada, when we've been in and out of the part where, yeah, you can go to a restaurant, but you have to place reservations in advance. I don't have to place reservations, because all I have to do is walk in and say, hey, how's your reservation situation? Are you full, or can I reserve right now? And before the person who's taking the reservations even pulls out their little sheet, usually the server who knows my order by heart comes and runs over and says, oh, he'll be out of here in 30 minutes. We already know what he wants. Just go ahead and seat him. The reason I bring that up is because now you're going to create a certain level of trepidation that if somebody wants they want to order their hamburger, but they do not want mayonnaise on it, they may not see an option that allows them to craft it exactly the way that they could craft it if they were standing at the counter speaking with a human being. And they're afraid that after all that process of waiting and the delivery and everything else, their hamburgers and have mayonnaise all over it.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have the opportunity to convey to a human being with that level of computer processing between their ears, hold the mayo.
That's right.
And the interface that was designed, the artificial intelligence interface that was designed, cannot comprehend that. Like, I'll give you an example. When I go to Subway, I have a Subway sandwich I created myself. It's based on their veggie sub, but I have it created a certain way. And I have the people, the one I go to, train that I want exactly 4 banana peppers on my sandwich. And I want them spread out evenly. The reason is because I know what banana peppers taste like, and I know what percentage of the flavor I want to be the banana pepper.
Oh, that's very specific.
Now imagine explaining that to a machine.
I don't think very many machines are going to get that.
There's the trepidation right there. That's why I brought it up.
Yeah.
So does the feeling economy involve resolving that issue so that I can feel comfortable going to a computer screen in my home and ordering that sandwich and knowing it's going to have 4 evenly placed banana peppers?
Well, sometimes at the current level of technology, you may need that person involved.
Yeah. So what you're saying is we may need a fail-safe in there where, if need be, we can bring in a human being to do the personal touch while at the same time allowing the technology to efficiently handled, but people say, well, just give me the number 8 with a Coke.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that is something that is happening, and it is on the way for sure. The computers are simply going to have more trouble dealing with those sorts of things. And humans are necessarily involved.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So this is a question I originally wasn't actually going to include this because I attempt as much as possible to avoid anything political on this show. And even if we do name things like presidents or things like that, we do it within analysis of an entrepreneurial related issue. I reread the question and I realized that this actually fits if it's handled a certain way, because the way you worded it is actually kind of a zinger. So I'm kind of excited about this one. Here goes. Is there evidence in recent political elections that empathy is now key and rationality is becoming less important?
Yeah, I think both things. And you see that happening really in the recent presidential elections. If you go back to 2016, we contend that the reason Trump won was that he indicated empathy toward the people who were left out by the thinking economy.
Right.
And those people were upset. They were unhappy. He identified their unhappiness. That's empathy.
Yeah.
And so that was why he won. And then, of course, when and he was sailing along, everything looked like he was going to be reelected. And then you had COVID happen. And suddenly Trump was revealed as not having enough empathy about COVID. And I think that was why Biden won the election.
I've spoken with a lot of people who believe things along those lines. I also believe that there was a lack, of empathy all the way across the board. I think certain things were politicized. I think there were places where Trump tried to help and he was just automatically labeled a certain way because they didn't like him. I think there are things he did that tried to help, and because they fought him on it, it actually made his efforts less effective. And I also believe that there's plenty of that to go around. It's not just the president. I think one of the things we discovered over the process of COVID is while everybody was focused on who's the president, what's the president doing, they didn't recognize the influence their own state governor had in their daily lives because it wasn't front and center. Yeah. So the moment the Trump administration comes out with the reopening plan and they say, these are guidelines, you states handle it as you see fit, call us if you need anything. Then you got to see there's a whole layer of power in this country that nobody was really paying attention to. And a few governors came out and they turned out to be superstars. I'm not going to say which ones they are because that'll cause an argument. And then you saw some that, oh my God, how these people ever slip under the radar? And different people have opposite views on who I mean if I start naming names, but if you want to talk about empathy, there's enough back and forth on that to go across the board for days.
Well, I think clearly you can find people who were very empathetic and very effective during the COVID situation on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah.
Both Republicans and Democrats.
I
agree that the what we've really seen is that this is getting more and more local. So in other words, it's not just the federal government, the mayors and the governors are very important players in this now.
Yeah, I think there's something to it. Now, I'm only relating has been shared with me, and this is at the Nevada level. So, because I live in Nevada, Las Vegas, and we have, compared to the level of draconianness, if that's a word, of lockdowns and restrictions, Nevada has actually had it comparatively light. It's still very rankling because, by nature, regardless of whether you call us a blue state or a red state, we are the type of state where people walk around casually with guns strapped to their waist, and a lot of them happen to be liberals and leftists. You go to the Halloween party on Fremont Street here in Las Vegas, and you have these people dressed up as Wonder Woman with a Glock strapped to their waist. I mean, it's that gives you an idea that it's actually somewhat more of a libertarian, we do as we want type culture, which is great. So any restriction is rankling.
Yeah,
I do give our governor some credit for the fact that we have avoided a lot of disasters we could have had. At the same time, I also know a lot of people who watch his speeches and his press conferences, and he comes across as that stern lecturing dad who can never be happy no matter if you brought home straight A's for 4 years, he would lecture you on how you failed in school. And it just, I mean, he just doesn't convey himself as the most warm, empathetic type person out there. Even as he protested, he's doing it because he cares about us. Right. So I think there's something about tonality too. And I know a few people who actually know our governor personally, and they say he's basically a big teddy bear. So I don't know for sure what to believe, except for the fact that perceptions and situations drive impressions of empathy.
Yeah, I think that's true. And what somebody's like in personal life may be different from what they are like in public life. For example, Hillary Clinton in 2016, I mean, according to some people who know her, she's a very kind and empathetic sort of person, but she really came across as cold.
Yeah.
And if you come across as cold, that loses in our current political environment.
Well, that we can go right back to the coal miners and their impressions on that one. And you brought up Trump's fortunes and how perceptions of empathy drove that. And I agree with you that part of the key to his win in 2016 is he showed empathy toward people who felt like they were being left out. What I would add to that is many people in this country, I think, felt left out because over and over again, politicians showed up with their 10-point plans. And they didn't even get to point one before they went the opposite direction. Whereas when you look at it, and I noticed this at the time because I studied several candidates, Trump being one of them, obviously, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Ted Cruz, and some of the others. I compared their campaign websites. Everybody's websites except Trump had all kinds of detailed 10-point plans, policy papers, and everything else. Trump's campaign had bullet points and announcements of the next rally.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that was key to it, because what he recognized is people were tired of plans. They just wanted to know stuff was going to get done. So he didn't come up with a treatise on the 5-year plan to border security. He said, build the wall. Yeah, he didn't say, let's create a plan to reduce the impact of lobbyists by regulating. He said, drain the swamp. So people could look at what he was saying and actually apply their own meanings to it. Build the wall could have literally meant build a wall. It also could have meant buy a bunch of drones. It could have meant build a bunch of military bases. It could have meant a lot of things, but it all fell under the general header of border security.
Sure.
And to me, that was somewhat empathetic because it allowed the human being who was receiving the message to infuse their own truth into it and come to believe it for their reasons, which I believe is a big part of empathy, is when you allow the recipient's own truth into it and validate that one way or another.
Yeah, I agree. That's certainly a winning strategy for politicians everywhere.
Yeah. Because, and again, and I know people, you know, Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, Greens, what have you, most of the people I know anyway are tired of 10-point plans because they never get past point one before they quote unquote lie. Because it's great as a politician to make a promise, then when you're in office, you find out what you can really do.
Yeah, that's often true. It might not be true with Biden. Biden has so many years of experience. I think he knows what's probably possible and what isn't.
I hope so. I really hope so, because as I said, when I'm a pilot on a plane, I want the pilot to be wildly successful.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, and to me, that's just an American statement. Whoever's flying the plane, I want them to have everything they need to deliver a nice flight experience, avoid turbulence as much as possible, and bring us to our destination smoothly, on time, and have the luggage be there when we go to the carousel.
Yep.
That's all I really ask.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, you're talking about flying a plane. One thing Southwest Airlines did was they said, we're not going to use the automatic pilot. You're going to actually fly the plane and you're actually going to land it. And what they were doing is they wanted people not to have a distance between the pilot and the plane. They wanted them to be one entity. Ooh. And it's interesting that, to the best of my knowledge, Southwest has never had a fatal accident.
No, not that I'm aware of. Wow. See, we could go on forever and ever. Unfortunately, we're at the top of the hour. So what I'd like to do now, Roland, is, you know, we may have you back at some point because I think there's so much more to discover. So please keep in touch with us. And when you have more, we may want to have you back on. I think this has given our listeners a lot to think about, not only in terms of technology, but also messaging, customer relations, how they evolve their customer service experience, and even how they position their offers to prospects, and the power of empathy and the feeling economy. So somebody wants to take this to the next place. How do they engage with you, and what do they have to look forward to when they do?
Well, I would say, first of all, the book, The Feeling Economy, is a really good place to start because that has all of our thinking on this topic. So that's a good place to start. And then, of course, we have lots of research papers as well, but not everybody can read those or wants to.
Yeah.
But the book is written for a normal person.
Oh, great. Well, I'm not a normal person, but I'll do the best I can. No, I seriously think I'm going to pick up a copy. It's called The Feeling Economy, How Artificial Intelligence is Creating the Era of Empathy, and it's available on Amazon right now. I do encourage all of our listeners to go pick that up. So, Roland T. Russ, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an honor, and believe me, an education.
Thanks very much, Adam.
All right. For everybody listening, I want to thank you again for being here. We trust you enjoyed today's episode. Check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And until next time, have a great day. Take care.